ABC Listen. Podcasts, radio, news, music, and more.
Tammy Shipley believed someone was out to hurt her.
I thought someone was after me and I wanted to just be safe.
She's put under 24-hour surveillance.
I tried to get in contact multiple times.
I just need to make a phone call. Nobody knows where I am.
And then something strange happens.
She just drank and drank and had something like 20 litres of pure water.
Ambulance emergency.
I've got a woman unconscious.
Tammy's story. Search Background Briefing on ABC Listen or wherever you get your podcasts.
Today, the Australian people have voted for Australian values.
The choice is simple for the Liberal Party. Change or die.
We need to have more Australian everything. We need to manifest a hyper-Australian.
We've always been about the planet, but we've got to make sure that people have their daily needs met.
People are starting to see that there is actually a different way of doing politics.
Hello and welcome to The Party Room. I'm Patricia Carvelis. I'm joining you from Wurundjeri country in Melbourne.
And I'm Annabelle Crabb. I'm not Fran Kelly, as is immediately evident. I'm on the Gadigal land of the Eora Nation here in Sydney. Pats, thanks for having me.
Always a pleasure, Annabelle. It's lovely to have you back on the podcast. And yes, evidently, because you have very different voices. Although, you're both Adelaideans.
We are. We come from a secret cabal of South Australian-born journalists. There are
who
many,
are in charge
of
everything. You're part of the global media conspiracy, which we'll get to in a moment. Fran is away this week. We're going to do things a little differently and have a good, solid chinwag, just the two of us. It's been a doozy of a week, and it's still very much unfolding, actually, Annabelle. We've got the memorandum of understanding between the US and Iran, and that's a big deal. We've got the One Nation leader, Pauline Hanson, and her press club address. And right now, we've got the Treasurer and the Prime Minister due to announce essentially the carve-outs to their big tax changes. Everyone's been waiting for this moment, how far they go, all of that, right? But Annabelle, I want to go back to that big moment and just get your first reflections. Pauline Hanson, 30 years in public life, a kind of, as one person who's pretty left-leaning, you know, in the kind of parliament said to me, whatever you think of her, she's an icon. And I thought that was really interesting. You know, she's you just know who she is. She's a household name, and she finally fronts the National Press Club this week.
My overriding concern, and that of the people I talk to, is that politicians today are good at talking but not listening. They will do anything to get your vote, but when that has been achieved, the voter is ignored. The public are sick and tired of being ignored.
Why was it such a big deal?
Well, principally because of that 30-year delay. I mean, you look around politics, there's not that many people who have been there for 30 years. There's Anthony Albanese, the Prime Minister, and there's Pauline Hanson, not many more. I thought it was fascinating because it was kind of the public interaction at last between Pauline Hanson and the massed forces of the Parliamentary Press Gallery, a group that she is habitually avoiding. I mean, most of her career, she's spoken selectively to some media outlets. She's banned others for stretches of time. And what's changed from now and 30 years ago is that she's now built a network using social media, which allows her to speak directly to supporters and potential supporters. And that is an unusually potent line for her. So when it was revealed that she was coming to speak to the press gallery at the press club, my first question was just, I wonder why she's doing that. I wonder why she's doing that.
Because she doesn't need to.
She doesn't really need to. And my own theory, and this could be wrong, I'm not basing it on any sort of secret squirrel briefing or anything, I think she was there for the content. Because the content of her being kind of challenged or questioned by conventional kind of legacy journalists and her kind of fighting back is a really big part of her content that she circulates on social media. So I thought you're here for the clips, but I mean that it may be unfair because also, you know, if you are currently, as she is, the preferred prime minister, according to not one, not two, but a series of polls, then there is an obligation to be open to scrutiny. And she did say that at the beginning of the address. But the rest of the address was, it was kind of like a trail of challenges thrown out to gallery journos there to kind of have a go at it.
My nation's news support brings with it much greater responsibility. I get that. And I can assure you that One Nation, its administration, its candidates and its leadership will prove we can deliver. It's your job to scrutinise my party, its people and its politics. Unlike the Prime Minister, I welcome it. I'm an elected representative and I should be scrutinised. That doesn't give you the licence to pile on.
I would be interested to hear your view of what the press gallery journalists, what approach they took in light of what turned out to be a very long and very provocative speech.
They clearly went in knowing that she wanted a Barney and not approaching it that way at all. I thought the range of questions were across content that wasn't even in her speech. You know, David Spears, who was on the podcast with me yesterday, asking a question about her tax policies. Smart to try and work out what do they stand for outside of the red meat to solidify their existing base and growing base. So I thought that was smart. I also didn't see an escalation in the journalists. Even Sarah Martin, who used to be in the press gallery, now is no longer in the press gallery, but I thought it was important that the press gallery had her there asking questions, given she's one of the main reporters really scrutinising One Nation. Her tone, even if Pauline Hanson was able to kind of have a go at her because she clearly does not like her. I think that's fair to say.
Right? I think that's I can infer that from her calling her a trash bag, yeah.
Senator Hanson, Sarah Martin from The Guardian. Taxpayers are paying more than $150,000 a year for your daughter, Lee Hanson, to seemingly campaign full-time in Tasmania while employed as a political advisor for a New South Wales senator. Did you have any role in appointing her to that position? Honestly, you never give up. I've never seen a person that's such a trashy journalist, you know, and what you put out all the time, you've got this obsession with constantly trying to pull down myself, my party, or Mrs. Reinhart. Whatever you do, you will be banned from my answering. I'll answer you this question today, but I'm telling you now, don't
she didn't, you know, everyone approached it not buying into the spectacle, but the spectacle largely happened because, of course, the get-up stunt. Now, the get-up stunt, I said yesterday, I'm not going to repeat myself. I stand by it, though. I've spoken to senior people in politics who think I'm a bit wrong, who say actually the long burn of what GetUp did in terms of the message is to get this wages issue on the agenda, to get her relationship with Working Class Australia, that she's allegedly not on Working Class Australia's side. So acts like she's for the battler, isn't for the battler. That's what that stunt did. I don't think so, because I'll tell you what I saw this morning. I got up and I saw a bunch of headlines which were all about the AFP investigation, the National Press Club and its deliberations, the infiltration. Barnaby Joyce's interviews last night mopping up the speech were all about the inside job at the press club. They weren't about Pauline Hanson's statement, which is that it should be easier to sack workers. She said that.
And I think that even that speech was a really good example of the way Hanson operates, which is to press a million buttons at once, right? Like the issues that she ranges over are kind of broad, simply conveyed, grievance-based, and shallow. So she will say in the same speech, I'm for workers, but also, why is it so hard to sack people? But also, people don't want to hire Australian workers because they don't show up to work and they're always on their phones and they're lazy. And then I think when she gets criticised for not showing up at the Senate, which is actually her job, you know, for which she gets paid extremely well, she's like, well, that's an attack. There is a comfortable coexistence with inconsistency, which makes it extremely hard to challenge, if you know what I mean, because it doesn't really bother her. And I think it's because her purpose is to reflect back to people whatever frustration they're feeling in their lives. And it's a mistake to look at the purveyor of that message and focus on her. Stay with me. I know this sounds like an argument for turning off journalism.
I'm always with you, babe.
It's not, but like it's listening more to the people who are picking up the phone now to pollsters and saying, whereas 10 years ago they might have said, oh, no, I would never vote for Pauline Hanson, now saying, yeah, actually I would. And if you listen to some of the, even the Vox Pops this morning that RN was doing, it's people saying, I would vote for her. I don't agree with everything she says. I think she goes a bit far on some things. And I think that that is where the core of One Nation support is. People who, you know, who was it that journalist at The Atlantic who wrote about Trump in 2016 that the media took Trump literally but not seriously, mm-hmm. and voters took him seriously but not literally. I think there's, you know, there's an allied phenomenon going on here. And I think the way to address it is not necessarily focusing exclusively on Hanson, it's understanding what is driving that really deep change in behaviour in the Australian population. Because it's kind of, even though they're very, very different policy-wise, it's directly connected to the Teal movement. I mean, it's the same thing.
It's the disruption.
But I thought it was an absolutely fascinating day. Just anthropologically, it was fascinating. I thought when you compare her to the Pauline Hanson who 30 years ago turned up for that 60 Minutes interview with Tracy Curro, and she was very shaky and very nervous. She felt as though she was an outcast in the sort of mainstream media and mainstream politics, because she was, and she was shaky and she didn't understand the word xenophobia when Tracy Curro asked her if she's xenophobic, and she just said, please explain. And everybody thought it was an incredibly embarrassing disaster. And 30 years later, that's her call sign. Like that's her brand, because her message is, I'm on your side against all of these assholes who have got a club. Literally, it's the press club. And I think journalists and media are a part of that. That's the message she's selling. It's kind of like, they all don't listen to you. The journalists don't listen to you. The Labor people don't listen to you. The coalition people don't listen to you. But I do. And I will have the courage to say what you're thinking, insert your own sentiment here, and no one else will. And that's what's sort of firing this train. And I think anything that reminds people that this is an institution that thinks Pauline Hanson is an idiot or, you know, whatever, it sort of assists her in her listening campaign, right? I mean, this is so ridiculous. I'm with you, I think, on the get up stunt. When I saw that thing unfurl yesterday,
it's good for her.
Now, the truth is that's a solid point. Pauline Hanson has one line on being, you know, for the ordinary people and for the workers and for the, you know, the nurses and the aged care workers or the childcare workers, or maybe she's got different views on childcare, but like she's for the ordinary person that, you know, works hard and helps out in their community, whatever. But she's also voting against measures to improve lives for some of those people. So that's a reasonable point to make. I just think being aware that being attacked by institutions or cabals or clubs in which ordinary Australians are not included is part of her business model is just sort of worth considering, I think, if you're making plans about how to proceed or how to handle it. I mean, you know, I'm not a strategic advisor for very obvious reasons, but I do think it's really interesting to watch this rearrangement that's happening. And I think it's a mistake too, as I hear some people saying, well, you know, this surge in support for One Nation just, you know, demonstrates that Australia's a racist country. I think you've got to have a look at all of the buttons that she's pressing and not assume that everybody's on board with all of the buttons. Do you know what I mean?
Oh, I absolutely don't think, and I've consistently thought this, that it's motivated primarily by culture and race. Yeah. And I say primarily because it is for some people, so to dismiss that that's a motivator is obviously silly.
Yeah.
But it's not the primary motivation for why you're hearing hordes of people suggest that it's okay to vote for Pauline Hanson now because they see her in a wider, through a wider lens than just a race lens, right?
I should say, before we move on, that's not to say that it's fine to live in a country where political leaders disparage, you know, members of a certain group on the basis of their religion or race. Like, I mean, I think that is something that most Australians would disagree with. But I think there has to be a really careful and listening-based analysis of what exactly is going on here, because it's like a bunch of things at once.
Now, Annabelle Crabb has written an excellent article, so excellent that I read it out loud to my nearly 17-year-old, and she was like, I don't want you to read it. When she heard it was Annabelle Crabb's piece, she let me read it.
Please convey my deep sympathies to that poor child.
She's fine. And that's all linked in the show notes, so you can find it there too. But it's not, there's so many things at once, and it's the perfect storm of economic frustration that's grown.
Yep.
And I think Labor's right to diagnose that as the principal issue. Labor, however, after that speech, have told me, and like the people that, you know, broadly matter in how they are going to now approach One Nation, because this is a movement that isn't just going after the Liberals, it's obviously going after the governing party. They see two areas worth kind of really mining in. One of them is really bloody obvious, and that's jobs and pay. And
yep,
that one gives, and she provided the lines. I mean, a few senior Labor people said to me, she actually gave exactly the kind of lines they needed her to say on that national platform to begin what will have to be a sort of forensic takedown of her in the next couple of years before the next federal election. And, you know, in Paul Erickson, who was very successful as a strategist, that is exactly what's going to happen now.
We see what they stand for over 30 years. We've seen it over and over again. They stand for talking about battlers but never representing battlers. They stand for dividing Australia, not uniting Australia. They stand for cutting workers' wages and entitlements, not improving living standards. They stand for getting donations from the big end of town, but talking about the needs of regional Australia. You know, we've seen who they represent and what they're prepared to engage in with One Nation leaders' visit to Washington, D.C. a few years ago.
And that you know, that when she said the whole industrial relations system has to change. It's too hard to sack workers. All of those lines, they were like high-fiving each other in offices.
Mm-hmm.
That's because they thought, we've got to. That's what they wanted to be said. That was said. Then the other one is a little on multiculturalism, and I'll explain. Only a little bit, though. There are some of the comments she makes on race and multiculturalism that even Labor lefties think do resonate, right? Where she went a little too far, and they will exploit, is even in being so specific in saying Mandarin and Arabic spoken at home, monocultural. Now, yes, even multicultural Australians think, you know, Team Australia broadly, you'll find in multicultural communities, including my own, those views are actually dominant very often. However, when you go to something as fundamental as cultural practice of just speaking your own language, I reckon, and I know Labor thinks, that is a scare campaign ready to happen.
Sure.
Now, one extra point. A Labor person tell me that One Nation's very active in WeChat, right? So they're very much cultivating.
That. That's interesting.
Yeah, it was, because they're monitoring it all the time. So she's in that space, and I thought, well, why did she say the Mandarin thing? This person said to me, she's in that space, but it's always the way that she frames it, and it kind of, let's see if it keeps working, it's always another ethnic group. It's not a, sort of a broad-based
ethnic
group.
That's the history of our Australian immigration pattern, isn't it? Where, I mean, it just is such a clear pattern. Like, it's depressing, unbelievably depressing, is we have this nation of immigrants, and our pattern is we get a wave of new immigrants from a particular region, and for the first 10 years we kind of go, oh, you seem a bit odd, and then we go, are you a criminal? Are you a criminal? Are you a criminal? Like, maybe you're a criminal. And then we go, your food is kind of delicious though. And then everybody's like, well, you're fine. We'll turn to the next wave of immigrants. And I mean, that kind of, I mean, I'm being so reductionist here, but, you know, I grew up in an area that was a first generation immigrant area. All of my friends at school were Greek and Italian kids whose parents worked in a market garden, and they interpreted, you know, for their parents. And then 15 years later, it was that school was full of Vietnamese kids because that was the next sort of wave of migrants. And I think there is definitely a sympathy for organised and restricted and controlled immigration into Australia from existent migrant groups. Yes, there is. And I expect that that is the sort of point that she'll be making. It's about, you know, it's about control. It's about being careful. It's about playing by the rules, which is a very Australian cultural kind of touch point, much as we think of ourselves as a nation of bushrangers, we actually do love to queue properly. So that's what I mean when I say, like, it's complicated. You can't just assume that this group of people is going to be outraged by this or, you know, drawn to that. I think it's really complicated, particularly around immigration. But even below immigration, kind of throbbing along as a consistent drumbeat is what's happening in the economy. And I mean, it is absolutely no kind of coincidence that the last time Pauline Hanson had a major surge was in the late 90s. So the recession that we had to have in the 1990s, plus a kind of John Howard articulated wave of frustration about political correctness and about reconciliation and land rights. Oh, it's all gone too far and so on. And remember John Howard's campaign headland speeches approaching the 1996 election, they were all about, you know, let's stop the rise of stultifying political correctness. Let's establish an Australia that is relaxed and comfortable with itself. Like, that was a really powerful campaign message. And I think we're seeing an allied set of circumstances at this point in history too.
So we get to the end of this event, which was a bit of a blockbuster event because of her polling and the surge in support. Where does it leave us? Does it leave us, I mean, we don't know till we get some real results, but with a Pauline Hanson and One Nation Party that's just solidified her existing support, or has she sent messages out to grow? Labor thinks there's enough in that speech now to sort of be able to even more precision strike her on certain grounds, and the union movement's going to be big on that, right? Then they obviously have the warm bodies to go out and do that, some of that work. And then for the Liberals, they say keep exposing the public to her. That's their strategy.
There are lots of questions to answer for One Nation. I judge people on their character and their conduct. That's how the Liberal and National parties approach things. If she wants to judge people based on the colour of their skin or their race, One Nation needs to explain that. They need to explain that. But our position on this is clear. Now, migration in this country has been too high and the standards have been too low, and that must change. But what we favour is a values-based immigration policy where people who come to this country adopt our core values.
And I thought it was really interesting yesterday, give you a little bit of how the sausage is made. Obviously, I do afternoon briefing every afternoon. I was not overwhelmed by Liberals wanting to come out and sort of denounce or compete with her lines. I had to work very hard to get the people I got on, like Paul Scar, who was named in her speech, and he came on and he's a sort of moderate that has a very different worldview for Australia and is pretty pro-multiculturalism, pro-SBS, all the things she wants to change. So very different kind of Liberal, a kind of Liberal that she says is why the Liberal Party's in decline, by the way.
And I noted also, PK, that Pauline Hanson called for the abolition of SBS. Can I say that Senator Hanson should in fact be watching SBS, not calling for its abolition? And if she was watching SBS, she would have seen our fantastic Socceroos get that wonderful victory over Turkey, and that That team, that Socceroo team, represents modern Australia, with team members from all over the world coming together, representing Australia and doing such a fine job.
And so the reason is they want her to be exposed more and more to the media. That's their strategy. They think she will become get undone, like she will, you know, do herself in basically through her answers, and that they should spend less time talking about her. That's their current new view, that they've spent too much time talking about her and that that's been detrimental to them.
I think it's useful to, hard as it is, just take the figure of Pauline Hanson out of this scenario. Like, she's a very eye-catching figure. She is, everybody's got a view. If you took her out, like, what is the Australian electorate responding to? Right now, it's coming off 20 years, nearly, of a revolving door of leadership ever since 2009. So it's not really 20 years, I can't add up, but like it's, let's say 15. Of two major parties that have swapped leaders a million times, that have run attack ads on each other whilst not really doing anything massively different from each other, that have chopped and changed their views on issues like climate change, that have poured resources into plotting against each other and bringing their own leaders down. And all of this is reported on by, you know, journalists who are massively interested in the ins and outs of the cat's ass of this process. And I think what's driving that disenchantment is just looking at those two organisms and thinking, do you know what? This is not really changing anything. And you seem more occupied with yourselves. I mean, witness the coalition in the last year. It's just been almost cartoonish. And we are so annoyed with that that we're even prepared to overlook the absurdity of, you know, Barnaby Joyce, who's been absolutely up to his fetlocks in all of this, you know, for years, and who also was a sort of signatory to the net zero deal that he now daily disparages. I mean, I think I would say to the strategists that are running around going like, oh, we've got her on this and, oh, this will make a great attack ad, I wonder if one of Hanson's strategic advantages in this field is that when people see an attack ad, they don't think, oh yeah, that's true. You know, she really doesn't show up to the Senate that much and we pay her to be there. Or like, oh yeah, what does it mean that Pauline Hanson's accepted a free plane from a billionaire? Like, do you think that means that Gina Rinehart will be affecting decision-making? They don't see that issue necessarily. They see, oh, here they go again, attacking Pauline because they're trying to kind of defend their own turf. And if that is people's perspective or opinion of the major parties, that is the fault of the major parties who have like spent the last decade or two telling everybody who'll listen how corrupt and hopeless and useless and inefficient and poorly motivated the other side of politics is. Is it surprising that after 15 years of that, everybody just now believes them?
Not terribly surprising. So we're going to do something radical. We're going to break the system. Crab, I need you to pause yourself.
Do I have to hit a button?
Look at this. I'm just going to even show people how we're doing it. Watch this.
We do consider there to be do you hear that? A special case.
Oh, okay, that's the Treasurer pausing. I'm going to hear the Treasurer announce the carve-out. See you in a minute. So I was playing the live press conference through my phone, through the microphone, where Crab's ears were listening, and then she was writing notes. I watch her. She's so old school. She's got a pen out. I don't know if it's a pencil. I couldn't quite see it.
It's a pen.
This is what's happened. The Prime Minister and the Treasurer have stood up together and announced what I think are quite significant changes to the original proposal to taxes taken to Australians on budget night.
Following the consultation that we flagged on budget night, we are announcing details to allow more small businesses access to the capital gains tax concessions. Today we're announcing that we'll increase the turnover threshold for existing small business 50% active asset CGT concession from $2 million to $10 million. This is one of the four concessions that we have said would continue. It is the most widely used of those four CGT concessions used by small businesses in Australia. We're also proposing to introduce a new innovative business tax concession for startups, and we'll release the consultation paper on the startup sector later this morning, and that will allow for further detailed consultation on the basis of that.
So already being framed, I've been scouring around the newspapers already as a backflip. I think that's fair-ish. Capital gains tax and trust taxes are being changed. Basically, the two big changes that I can see here are they've dumped the taxes on discretionary trusts. That's the so-called death tax campaign you may have seen particularly going around. They have moved away from that. And then they've done this thing, which I kind of think it was well known that they might go here. The Prime Minister revealing the annual turnover threshold for Australian businesses looking to access the CGT concessions that used to be there, the carve-outs basically. It's been raised from $2 million of turnover to $10 million. That's very generous. That's actually higher than what COSBOA was calling for, actually, which is the small business lobby. Annabelle, hot takes from you. Is this like a triple backflip or just a kind of, you know, little change?
It's totally remarkable because, I mean, we've seen, Jim Chalmers is right to say, oh, there's often, you know, tweaks to budgetary, you know, we have an inquiry, we have processes and whatever. But normally when a government announces or even campaigns on, you know, a tax change, they negotiate because they're in the Senate with the legislation and they are dealing with somebody. I mean, like, you remember the GST once the Democrats got involved? Remember that? Because the Democrats, God rest their kindly souls, were kind of like, we'll consider letting through the GST as long as you exempt fresh food. And then there was a 9-month deliberation about, you know, whether lavash bread was in and crumpets were out or whatever. Like, it was just wild. But at least there were parties to that negotiation. This sort of looks like the government sort of negotiating with itself. Like, it's just sort of having this kind of, there's only one guy in the room. Do you know what I mean? And it's fascinating to me because I think, well, okay, well, if on reflection you think that the threshold should be 10 million instead of 2 million, like, possibly better to do that before the budget than after the budget, if you're going to, do you know what I mean? And so I think no one can ever really, on that basis, deny that what's happened here is that the government has been surprised by the strength of the backlash. And I think they were very focused on, you know, what would happen with the negative gearing and, you know, the real estate angle. And the thing that people were really pissy about was, you know, the effect on small business of the capital gains tax changes. So this change in the threshold is aimed squarely at all of those people who went on social media going, here's my new silent partner, Anthony Albanese, taking 47%, which is, you know, not an accurate reflection of the situation. But that's what this is about.
So they've blinked.
Yeah.
I'll tell you, I think it's interesting that they've dumped the discretionary trust change. Clearly, I see a lot of the Prime Minister in this. He wanted to shut down the death tax thing.
Yep.
Unfortunately for him, though, this is just my political analysis. Once the door opened, yes, he may have shut it now, but I don't think it completely puts that away once it's out.
Oh, I don't know. His words is bond, Patricia. Maybe he could just say, I'll never, ever do the discretionary trust changes. But yeah. I mean, look, the death tax thing, A, it's not a death tax. B, it doesn't affect very many people. C, it's not that difficult to sort of organise your affairs around it. Anyway, I think there's, for the size of the change, not big, there was a disproportionate and easily simplified scare campaign that could be run, because there is a weird thing that happens in the Australian brain when the term death taxes is floated. And I think they decided that it was too much trouble. and too much risk, which, I mean, again, what's it doing in the budget in the first place? That it's not like, you know, it would harvest so much money that it would be worth weathering that campaign. I mean, I remember on budget day, a couple of people in our lockup going, oh, that's surprising. Surprising to see that in there. And now it's not. Gonski.
And now it's not. And then, of course, the threshold for small businesses. That means essentially every one of the 2.7 million active small businesses in this country will have access to the generous capital gains tax concessions. That's Jim Chalmers' direct line. 98% of all active businesses will be eligible for these concessions. So it was about 91% that were eligible. It goes up now to 98%. I think they think that's an easier thing to win. This is a small group of businesses, smaller group, that will be affected by what could be effectively a higher tax when they sell the business. It will not stop the Coalition and One Nation saying that these things are unfair, but I think it does perhaps deal with some of the grievance we were seeing in the community about it. Jim Chalmers also, Annabelle, confirmed the government's backflip on these changes. It's going to cost the budget. So, you know, they had a certain amount they were bringing in, now bringing in less, tell you how much less revenue they'll be bringing in, $475 million over the next 4 years.
Right. From a base of about $8 billion, wasn't it? Like that was the...
It's not a huge amount though, but yeah, I mean, they're foregoing that amount of revenue, $500 million essentially, because of these backflips. And he said that'll all be in MyEFO. Yeah. So
I mean, with the budget, I was sort of interested in the response, which was really viscerally about the impact on investors in shares and people building their own businesses and so on. And I think the Albanese mantra that that people shouldn't be disadvantaged because they have a salary and they have a job and they earn a wage and they pay a tax. I think it's a solid argument, but it probably, I don't know, there seems to, that the number of people who do make income from in other ways and are accustomed to doing that because of the incentives are furious about having them withdrawn. And I think what we're seeing today is a recognition of that and a softening of the stance. It does confuse things, though, I think, because every carve-out complicates the tax system even more, right? Mm-hmm. And we've got grandfathering and we've got, you know, so it's a complexity that lends itself well to scare campaigns, which is, of course, you know, what will be happening from this point on. And it's not assisted by the fact that Albanese now can't say, well, I said I won't do that and I won't, because the obvious response is, yeah, you said that a bunch of times about a bunch of other stuff. So, you know, we can't, got to sleep with one eye open, you know. But I think what I'm interested in your view on is what happens now. Like they've had a 14-second inquiry and they've come up with these changes, they've announced it today, next, you know, they'll be popping that into the Senate. So what happens when it gets to the Senate, Patricia? Is there another round of amendments? And, you know, they need to have either the Coalition or the Greens support
this
package.
Well, they're not getting the Coalition. There's no way they're getting the Coalition. So it's the Greens.
That'd be a turn up for the books, wouldn't it?
That'd be exciting. I think you're likely, and it hasn't happened yet, but that the Greens will say, why they, you know, backflipped on some of this, and you'll get a bit of hairy-chested language from the Greens. Mm. But I think the Greens, I mean, I've spoken to a couple privately who get how hard it's been for the government to land and will not, I believe, stand in the way of it.
Look, we're having discussions with government, but we have been entirely clear from budget night that we think keeping 95% of the tax perks for ultra-wealthy property investors is not going to fix the housing crisis.
I think they just figure, oh, things are pretty tough out there. There is a sort of recognition from some of the more pragmatic Greens that I think are winning this particular fight, that, you know, they can't be letting this bleed out. And even that their government has today announced these carve-outs speaks volumes, because originally they were briefing, it might take a couple of months, no rush. This is a...
Stay the course.
Yeah, this is, to me, the most clear sign that they realised the heat was too hot and they needed to take some of the heat out, and that's today's attempt to try and clean up some of the concerns. And this will, I think, deal with some of the concerns of small business. Not everyone will be happy. You'll hear a lot of criticism still, but this is kind of the deal that the government feels like it can land and sell, so that the Prime Minister, you heard him, he wants to talk about young people getting into housing. He feels like this neutralises the other stuff, so he can talk about that, which is his chief political line. He thinks that's a winner.
It is. He looks across the board and goes, that's the winner. It's like, I mean, what is, yeah, what's he selling after this? I don't know. Like, I mean, I've always thought, right, they've done this in the budget. They've got a bit of a war chest. They'll come back in the next couple of years with the payoff, right? Like the income taxes or the income tax cuts or the whatever. I think there's a sense that this is a now issue and that it has to be addressed now. You can't like wait for it to sort of get better down the track. I just doing a call back to what we were talking about earlier, Patricia, I would be interested to know, because I think when I saw the budget and it had so much kind of substantive reform in it, and then I saw in the same week the reply by Angus Taylor, not only opposing all of that, but then going really taking a huge step in another direction, i.e., you know, announcing that he would index tax brackets, which is an enormously expensive thing to do, very bold. Is it a coincidence that at a time when there's a rise in One Nation and disaffection with this sort of perception of a uni party with where the Labor and Liberal Party don't really do anything very different from each other, is that why we're seeing these major parties actually making decisions that set them apart from each other? Is this an example of kind of Australian democracy working between elections? That's my question.
Yeah, and it just shows that Australian democracy has become much more pointy all the time. It's, you know, remember in the middle of a political cycle, Annabelle, when you and I both were in the press gallery, mm-hmm. it was the middle of the political cycle, usually it's time for governing, you know, just every day, just get on with it. Now, I felt like this week was an election campaign, for crying out loud. It had the sort of energy of that competition. I think everything has become much more hyper-focused because, you know, algorithms, social media, the urgency, the sort of level of grievance. Like there's everything is hyper.
And the audibility of grievance. But we shouldn't forget as well that, I mean, this is the first second term government with the same prime minister that we've seen since basically 2004. I mean, Howard in 2004 wasn't a second term prime minister, but like Howard in 2004 was the last prime minister to win an election having won the previous one, which is wild, because what's happened in the last 20 years is basically people getting elected and then getting necked by their own party. So, like, this is a rare thing to see, a prime minister in a second term. Anyway, I just leave you with that. I know we're running out of time. And you've got your other job to go to, or your other 20 jobs.
You've got another 30 jobs to go to too. Well, that's it for the Party Room today. Annabelle, hanging out with you is always a delight. Thank you so much.
I've loved it. Thank you, Patricia.
Tomorrow, Mel and I will bring you the latest and answer your questions as well. So we're going to get to the Iran-US deal and how that's being framed and the fallout from these tax changes too, and anything else we can come up with. Send your questions to thepartyroom@abc.net.au. David Spears will be back for Insiders on Background on Saturday. Remember to follow Politics Now on ABC Listen so you never miss an episode. See you, Annabelle.
See ya.